all I have to do, I know, like in the summer, is I have to get outside. If I can get outside, weeds will get
pulled.
Once
you're out there, you'll see a weed and you just start pulling it out.
Yeah, if you pull, you can't just pull one weed because there's one right next to it, you know? So then, like,
the ADHD kicks in.
Yeah, exactly.
Butterscotch
shenanigans. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 289 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast, Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm the webs programmer.
I'm Sam, and I'm the art programmer.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is December 11, 20 Blundy. Before we get started, we have a warning. There's going to be profanity on this show, so, you know, just expect it. We'd also like to thank our recurring supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. If you'd like to help support this podcast, let us grab your money at moneygrab.bscotch.net. All right, let's talk about life. Adam has a boring story, or a bory, if you will.
Yeah, we've been talking lately about mental health, and then for Sam in particular, talking about ADHD, and then for me and Seth talking about we need to get evaluated, probably, etc. And so, so finally, a month or so ago, got my appointment made, and I think I talked about that a bit on the podcast. And so, had that was it yesterday? Two days ago. Finally did it, and it was one of those things where I've had also talked about in the podcast before. For me, being able to name a thing is extremely valuable, because then you can discover this is how my life is. This is how I'm different than other people. And now you can, now instead of it being a thing that you've been unconsciously fighting or something like that, it's now just something you can work with. Right. So for me, that was like aphantasia a few years ago, which we talked about a bit. And so this time, I've already talked about all this stuff so much about do I have ADHD? I've got all these symptoms. I seem to have some kind of mild depression going on. There's these things I've already just talked about at length. So then I didn't know what it was going to be like actually then sitting down and talking to a real psychiatrist and saying here's what's going on with me. What is this? You know, what do I need to deal with? And then in the end, so had this appointment, sat down. He just asked a jillion questions. We chatted a bit. And at the end of it, he didn't even say oh yeah, this is definitely ADHD. Cause I actually forgot to ask at that point. I'd be is there an official, diagnosis here? All he said was, given all of this stuff, he's I think there's a pharmacological solution that just perfectly fits with your constellation of things that you're dealing with. Right. And then he was I think before he became a psychiatrist, he was a pharmacologist. So he's really into how drugs work, you know? And of course I had my background in biological science. And so
did you guys nerd out?
We were just drawing diagrams and talking about how the different neurotransmitters work and how the different kinds of drugs impact the different things, and why the one that he wanted to prescribe to me, in particular, worked well for my stuff, which is mostly kind of mood related, with this mildly depressed state that I've been dealing with. And so we kind of talked through it, and then he gave me a prescription, and then I left. And as I was leaving, I was because I was ready to come home and unpack all this with my wife, because we always talk through all this stuff, you know. And I got home, and she's okay, so how'd it go? And I was and I just realized, I have nothing to say about this. It wasn't even interesting.
Fine.
Yeah, there
was
no.
To the dentist.
I wasn't nervous going in, because I was I just needed, because I wasn't worried about the outcome. I just wanted to see if something was going on and if it could be addressed, you know. And the outcome was yeah, there's something going on here, which I already knew. That's why I went there in the first place. And so it was just. I think it was funny how hilariously just uninteresting the whole thing turned out to be. You know,
isn't this kind of it's a big deal because of the impact.
Yeah.
Right. But also it's not a big deal because you can just go talk to somebody and they can just be here you go. Here's some drugs. Right. So it feels like there should have been a much more monumental thing that happened, you know, when you solve this big problem.
Yeah.
But really it just wasn't a big deal. And then you can just get your stuff and move on.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting thing, right? I only wanted to tell that story because originally I was this is not an interesting story. So I don't want to tell it. Right. But there's just so much, stuff wrapped up in mental health about like how you're supposed to feel about getting a diagnosis of some sort and fear about revealing to somebody how like your brain works and how you feel about stuff and all of this. And that's all like been ingrained in us. So it's completely valid to have those feelings and thoughts, right? Because you've been told you have to for your entire life. But there, you know, there is another path, which is the boring path, where it's just like any other medical thing, where it's like if you break your leg, you're not like, oh, I'm embarrassed that my leg is broken. You know, I don't want to tell somebody I did. Although there are people who do that. If we go to our sort of our Midwestern family of stuff, people who believe they can't get injured, and that any injury of any sort is a weakness, then you know it's everywhere, right? But yeah, I was just kind of relieved that my response to a mental health thing that I was dealing with was just as boring as my normal medical stuff. And so I just wanted to have that message basically be like, it can be that way, right? Yeah, which is not to say that that's an easy thing to do. Absolutely. Right. And depending on the kind of diagnosis you're dealing with and all that, it's a very different outcome. But I think the interesting thing is that because my wife and Sam already went through this process of like getting that moment of discovery and clarity, like, holy shit, this is why things were. Mm-hmm. Then I'd already basically gone through that process.
Yeah,
right.
Cause you were like, wait, me too. In X, Y, Z. Yeah. Particular constellation.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I actually already got to do all the processing. So that then finally going to the doctor to get it like formally dealt with was then just boring.
Yep.
Yeah. I think the reason that this mental health stuff is so hard to grapple with is because it doesn't hurt. You know, like if you have a headache and you're like, fuck, ow, no problem. Take some drugs. Pain is gone now. I can obviously, right? Like there's a clear, like direct, immediate, negative, painful like thing that you have going on and a very obvious, clear resolution of it. But with a lot of these mental health things, something is wrong, but it's not necessarily pain, right?
Yeah, well, but it's this idea of like what you're allowed. It's this idea that that there are certain things that you have to figure out how to deal with without any external help, right?
Yes.
And pain is one of those things where we've all collectively agreed that pain, yeah, you're allowed to like to deal with that. You're allowed to be like, oh, I can't work because like my arm is in so much pain because I have carpal tunnel syndrome that I can't type. You know, people are like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Right. Yeah. But then as you start moving away from that towards things that are not physical pain, then there's a much less acceptance for the idea that like, oh, I'm having like a particular kind of mental health crisis today. Right. So like, I just can't do this. Right. And then now people are like, you should be able to figure that shit out yourself. Like you should be able to just deal with that. Right. So there's a weird, we've all drawn very weird lines about what is and is not acceptable. And also like whether or not you should treat things pharmacologically. Right. Mm-hmm. Where some people won't even take drugs for physical pain. Right. Because they have this like belief that that's a thing you just have to deal with. You just handle it. And like all drugs are bad. Right. But the more you move away from physical pain into mental distress of some sort, the more likely it is that any given person is like, I don't believe you have the right to treat that with a pharmacological solution. You know?
Well, there is this kind of like this like toughness thing that people have with pain, you know, this idea of like mm-hmm. being proud of being able to withstand a lot of pain, or if something hurts a lot, but pretending like it doesn't hurt a lot and just carrying on with your business. Like, for me, man, give me the drugs. Like, sure.
That's where I'm at.
I can, if I don't have an option, like, sure, I can power through it if I have to. Like, I had that stupid tooth thing for forever. But, you know, after I got the tooth thing fixed, I was like, oh yeah, this is obviously better. Like this is so much better to just not be in pain. So yeah, I don't know.
My take on it is that, you know, there are and will be plenty of things in life for which there's no appropriate ability nor method to address them.
Oh yeah.
And to dull the impact for you. And so if it's possible to get a diagnosis for something, and then get treatment for it, whether it's pharmacological or, you know, talk therapy, whatever, you know,
physical intervention of some sort.
Yeah. If there's some form of intervention available, then then you should be taking it. Because importantly, I think you shouldn't be using up your toughness on dumb shit like a toothache, because at some point something actually bad's going to happen. Uh-huh. And if you're dealing with that while you have a toothache, guess what? Like you're not ready. You're like your pain threshold is already hitting some form of max, right?
But also just why? Because like the whole idea that that there's some sort of a virtue in having a thing that you're dealing with that you don't have to deal with, you know? Because like sure, you could, right? As Seth is saying, like you can.
Well,
right?
I mean, it's impressive, it. You know, in the way.
But is it impressive or is it just dumb?
Well, it's both. You know, this is the whole thing about like what bravery is, right? It's like or courage. It's not having fear. It's having fear and ignoring it, right? And so it's like there's definitely some virtue stuff wrapped up, I think, in the idea of like experiencing a tremendous amount of pain and then not like caring.
But is there also like there's a fear of looking weak by being like, oh, I have a headache. I need to. Anybody have Excedrin? Like, I can't get my shit done today because my head just hurts, right? Mm-hmm. And like admitting to that, like people are worried about how other people will perceive them, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so well, fairly because people are assholes about this sort of thing.
Sure, yep, but like there's a strength in being able to just say what you need and do your shit, you know?
Yeah, but like, I mean, emotional connectivity like with yourself is not exactly a thing that people, I think, especially on the male side of the equation for this stuff, promote in any sort of healthy way.
Yeah, it's right? All about that. How toxic can we get our masculinity, you know?
Yeah, but I think, I mean, I guess my general framing for this stuff is that there are things for which you cannot be ready. So be ready with regards to the things you can be ready for. And otherwise, you're going to be totally fucked at some point because you're not – you just got too much on your plate. So I think – mental health is one of those things. The physical health stuff, all of it. Like anything you can take care of, it should be addressed because there's things that you can't, that you just have. Speaking from experience, that you're just going to have to fucking deal with. So,
you're just going to have to deal with.
Sometimes ideally.
But it's also – I mean this is also like the fucking – you know, the fruit sticker problem that Seth mentioned a million years ago.
Right? 100%,
yeah. And the idea of minor nuisances, right, where – because we talk about this with work, right? Where it's like, okay, yeah, if your work has a collection of sort of minor nuisances, where every day you sit down, you perform some set of the same tasks to like get your process started. Every day you sort of create the same kinds of errors, you know, like this sort of stuff, right? Then yeah, you can deal with that, right? You can continue manually dealing with that stuff, or you can find ways to prevent those from happening anymore, or to automate those processes and then make your daily life better. That exact same logic applies to physical and mental health, right? Mm-hmm. Just because you can put up with it, and it's even less about like saving up for those things where now you can't, there is no work around it. And it's just the fact that like, if you don't have to deal with that stuff, that's better.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. So don't. Yeah. Well, that was very boring, Adam. Very exactly. Boring.
I'm medical so adventure.
So thanks for the inspirational bory. On that one.
The boy.
As far as studio news goes, we got a cool one, which is Levelhead is in the top 100 indie games for the year, for their year-end roundup for IndieDB. And I believe there's some kind of community vote-a-thon thing.
That's going on right now. So to get us in the top 10, which would be rad, because I believe we were in the top 10 last year. We were an editor's pick for community management last year. As an unreleased game, then we can actually probably, I think, land in the top 10 again. So if you want to go take, you know, a minute or two, sling a vote our way. If you go to indiedb.com, there's just a big thing that's like top 100 voting. Click on that. Click on platformer. Vote. Levelhead's right there. Boom. Click on it. Just three clicks. Yeah. That's all.
Yeah. That's all. That's all the studio news we're going to talk about.
Yep.
Because this week is Cyberpunk week.
Yep.
And let's talk about it. Let's talk about Cyberpunk. So this game has been hyped forever. It was revealed, like a year and a half ago or something. And the reveal was basically, look, it's a dystopian hellscape with lots of bright lights. People got weird stuff on their bodies. And Keanu Reeves is there.
Yep.
Also, it's made by CD Projekt Red, the creators of The Witcher. So you bring all those things together, and the entire world just collectively shat their pants right off of their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And importantly, this game was announced back in 2012, I think.
It was 2012. Holy shit.
Yeah. It was like really? 8 years ago when they said they were working on it. Yeah.
Jesus.
So the hype train has been long rolling and is roaring.
So I want to say just right out of the gate, this game was so hyped. So they had 8 million pre-orders. Okay. The Witcher 3 had 1.5 million. It's like sort of
Jesus Christ. Perspective.
This game broke the Steam concurrent users record with 1 million concurrent users.
For a single player game.
Yeah. For a single player game. Which, of course, concurrent users literally don't matter for a single-player game. But it is impressive.
But it's the part that's remarkable, because I think at the time they were actually not beating out like launch day numbers and stuff for multiplayer games, but I think they were in the top 10 or like even beating all or most of all of the top Valve multiplayer games for concurrency.
Yeah, probably the only things above them at that point is like Dota.
Probably.
the hype for this game was so big, so huge – that CD Projekt Red's stock price dropped by 8% because of this news that they had 1 million concurrent users and had 8 million pre-orders, because people were expecting it to do even more than that.
Well, I think it was
so that's some hype.
Their initial Metacritic scores came out and they got, I think it was like a 91%, which I think is part of also what caused their stock to drop. Again, same thing. 91% as far as Metacritic caused them to lose
10% right. It's price. Like one of the best Metacritic scores you can get, you know, in the 90s.
Yeah, the article I saw.
Not good enough.
That makes it just the fourth best PC game of this year. And I was like, I mean, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, it came out. Good.
But again, according to like an aggregation random reviewers. Yeah, so this game is doing great, obviously. Sam got to play around with it for a couple hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so I think that's the interesting thing about it. Because if you read the reviews, there's two major things that are mentioned. And there may be like light spoilers for it in this following discussion. So if you don't hear anything about the biggest game launch to have happened literally probably ever, then just fast forward a bit. But the reviews so far have mentioned sort of two interesting things. So one is there's something like a business and like a run in your shit level, which is that comically, Cyberpunk is launching a game about a dystopian future, or is a game about a dystopian future in which, you know, corporations rule everything. Everyone is like hacking their own bodies to create. They're basically people are like man-machine hybrids sort of across the board. A variety of cyborgs and stuff. Freaky, some not, etc. And in this dystopian world, and you know, the companies control everything. And comically, CD Projekt Red also made people sign an NDA about talking about their game, reviewing the game, showing any footage of the game for the console versions in particular before the launch of the game. So in other words, no one actually got to see screenshots of what the game looks like on consoles
after launch day. Yeah. Or I guess till launch day. Players were posting them.
Yeah. And people couldn't share anything aside from marketing B-roll. So you couldn't capture your own stuff. So there's this really intense lockdown on information flow, which, you know, when you look at CD Projekt Red, like they're a publicly traded company in Poland, where they're located. And but they only have The Witcher. Like it's The Witcher series and then like Gwent. I think they made a card game, kind of Hearthstone-esque. You know, out of it. Mm-hmm. But they don't exactly have a lot of games going on. It's like The Witcher.
They own GOG.
Right. They own GOG as well. But they don't have like too much going on. And so, you know, this is one of those scenarios where if this game does poorly or whatever else is perceived poorly, yeah, you're going to have literally a stock price hit. Like it's guaranteed. So there's a lot of incentive here on a corporate level to do some fucked up stuff, which is great because it's the same story as the game, you know?
Well, yeah, and also like all the tales of crunch and everything, which is also the other big part of the discussion, right? Of basically treating their employees like things that they own and the whole deal. Like, yeah, it butts up hilariously against the premise and the world in which the game lives.
Yeah, it's the same. Actually, it's the same damn thing, which is incredible. So For those who are not familiar as well, the game was originally supposed to come out in April. You know, to meet that deadline, the teams were already crunching at that time.
I think they crunched for six months leading up to that. Crunch meaning like working 80 hours a week or more, mandatory for everybody on the team. So that's typically how that goes.
And they also, kicked it to September and then also kicked it to December. The team's crunching the whole time. So in other words, the team has essentially been crunched, I don't even know, like probably a year and a half, 2 years or some crazy shit, which is also madness. So these are the sort of high level weird things that are happening in the background of this game coming out.
During a pandemic.
But, yeah,
there's not to mention.
Yeah, so it's sort of frankly like the Duke overarching soup that this thing is swimming in is just a fascinating one that we could dive into. But I did actually play the game. Importantly, I didn't pre-order it, but I got it the day of because on Steam, of course, they had a huge takeover, and I was like, oh yeah, I forgot this was happening. So went ahead, got it, played through it, and I got to say, one, is it like. Very, very pretty. Yes, absolutely. Is the world building really intense and thorough? Yes. Have I enjoyed it a lot? It's fine. Honestly, it's fine. And I think that's also been reflected in a number of the general critical opinions about it too. And to anybody who says that it's because it was rushed out or they just needed more time, I completely disagree. There's some big structural choices at the bottom of this game that I think make it so that in my mind, like it's like an 8, maybe 7 or 8, which as far as like a hype train rolling into the station, like that is not what you want to show up, to show up there.
Cause it might as well be a 1 at that point,
Well, truthfully, I mean, how many lives did you destroy to make this product that everyone's like,
it's fine. Yeah.
And so yep. the litany of problems, that I have with it are, again, none of them related to bugs either or graphics. I don't give a shit about any of that stuff. You know, I love indie games and play a lot of 2D stuff. So graphical fidelity is not something I'm like going to have any issues with. I didn't have any bugs in my playthrough. What I do have an issue with is a number of the design choices that have confused the shit out of me. So first off, let's just talk about, just briefly at least, in the character creator, you get to choose your genitalia, okay? You get to customize it.
It's a big story point later on.
Yeah. So why though? Right? This hasn't come up in any way, shape, or form as in the rest of the game. I think I saw myself naked once in a mirror, but that was like I think that was probably the only glitch I had. I definitely had clothes on. My hair and my clothes just disappeared looking at me.
Well, there is a bug people were experiencing though, where when they looked at themselves in a mirror naked, their handcrafted, customized genitals weren't even there.
Yeah,
the mirror doesn't reflect them.
they're vampiric.
Yeah,
and so that's one of those questions where I'm like, what in the hell did you do this for?
What is it? Well, but I think this kind of butts up against another interesting thing, which is like the puritanical American perception of sex and genitalia, all this kind of stuff, mm-hmm. right? Because like, there's nothing that we should be like. Because on the one hand, this shouldn't be a problem from this is like gross or whatever kind of a way, right? Or inappropriate or whatever. But even though that's true, still why though?
Yeah, it was mainly just
because then what's the first thing that happens? You put pants on and then you move on with the story. Yeah. And that's it.
Yeah. I've never seen those genitals the whole rest of the game, except for on accident. So that's what I mean by it. Like, as far as I don't care.
As far as spending a bunch of development resources
that's
on something that just doesn't actually do anything at any future point or come into play in any meaningful way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why? So that's number one, which is, just confusing. And then number two is I think the overall marketing for it is such that it very much says that this is like an open world RPG, right? Where you can kind of you choose your destiny to a degree. You're like making your own character, but the way the story is delivered feels much more like an on rails single player experience. If that makes sense, it's far less of an experience of you. At least of what I've played for like probably 7 or 8 hours. It's far less of an experience where you feel like you're making critical decisions and more like very much more like you're along for the ride. And And I do mean this in a bad way, because there's been a number of times, I don't know how many times this game, I think it's been 4 times now in 8 hours, where my character has been just like punched in the face. I've been knocked out. And then I just wake up somewhere else. And and in the flow of a conversation where I couldn't do it, does there doesn't appear to be a way that I could have not gotten punched in the face. You know what I mean? It's so it's supposed to like the promise of quote open world games typically is like, you know, go anywhere.
Sort of a Grand Theft Auto situation. Like, here's a whole city, just go do whatever.
Yeah.
And whatever you want.
And weirdly enough, like they take away control of the player character a lot during the story moments. And I have ridden in cars. As a passenger in a car through Night City, which the first time I did it, I was like, this is cool. I'm like looking out the window. Neat. But then since then, I've just been like, there's been, I think, 2 helicopter rides. I think 3 more car rides where I was just a passenger just hanging out while someone's talking to me for like, and I don't mean a short period of time. I mean like fucking like 15 minutes each time. This happened last night. I hit like what I thought was a critical story point moment, basically get knocked out in one form or another. 20 minutes of me like not doing fucking anything and also being very confused. Okay. Because the narrative itself is also very confusing. The only reason I knew it was going on was because I had read a tip on the loading screen like 3 hours before and happened to remember most shit that I read. Right. So like,
right.
Otherwise I would have been like, what the fuck is going on? So, I'm like, okay, whatever, you know, and I saw some people where they're like, oh, but the characters are so heartfelt. I haven't felt a thing for these people. I'm going to be honest. And if you say like, at first I was like, maybe I have a problem, but interestingly, I played Dragon Age Origins for a couple of days leading up to this. This game came out in 2009. Okay. Mm-hmm. Another RPG. I felt more in the first 15 minutes of that game than I have felt this entire fucking time. I'm going to be honest.
Yeah.
So there's that. And then,
but to be fair, Dragon Age Origins is, in my opinion, one of the best RPGs ever made.
It's absolutely fantastic. But I think, you know, given the hype around Cyberpunk, it's appropriate to try
to compare.
You
would think it would be up there also, but yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
And then does it feel like, because this is one of the things I worry about kind of modern, you know, AAA and where it's going with like, because we just saw the trailer for a new arc with Vin Diesel as a character now, yep. Right? And one of the things I worry about with these is that it's extremely difficult to have the level of technical impressiveness, right?
Yes.
That you're getting in a game like this, while also having it be a game, right? Because games are things that give you choice and options and skills and like and divergent paths of way things can go and all that kind of stuff, and the more costly it is to develop the game, the less of those things you can do because you have to deal with the technical implications of every one of those player choices that you allow for are enormous. And so by having these like turn into more and more like basically cinematic experiences, it seems like at least for a while, the end result of that has to be that you are making a movie, you know?
Yes.
And you're trying to give as much player agency within the movie as you can. But it's a movie though, right? There's only so much you can do because the budget explosion for player choice is just – it's too much. You can't control it. So yeah. Does it feel when you're playing this game like, mm-hmm. like basically they wanted to show you the city that they had made because it's so impressive. So they put you in a helicopter. But they don't want you to fly the helicopter because that would have meant they had to deal with the fact that you could go anywhere. Like, is that what it feels like?
That's sort of the vibe. And importantly, like, you know, I played God of War as well, which is like very much a cinematic experience in the same vein where you're like, just the whole time you're frequently just like, holy shit. Like, wow, I don't even know how they did any of this stuff. Right. But that one feels extremely well put together where the cinematic aspects of it bleed perfectly into the gameplay and you are doing stuff a lot like the storytelling is done in such a way that it doesn't feel like it's sort of.
But it's also a very combat heavy game, right? So like, and not open world.
Yes, well, it is. Yeah. So it's that same sort of thing where it seems like it's open world when really it's a couple different corrals that you
right.
you know get moved through. But yeah, so I think the overall effect for me has been one of just sort of. Really pointing out all of these, it's like you can have infinite budget. You can destroy many lives in the process of, you could consume a lot of souls to make a game. But none of those things by itself will determine whether or not it's any good. And we talk about this on the podcast quite a bit, especially as we lead up to Crashlands 2 stuff, which is the decisions you make at the outset of a game structurally are the most important decisions around the game. And that's what I mean when I say I don't think there's not a patch that could fix this, if that makes sense. There's a billion other problems I have with it. Like, you get calls on a cell phone fucking constantly in the game. You get text messages from the same cell phone fucking constantly. People are just interrupting. You're just like, I'm trying to go out here to shoot people. I'm getting phone calls constantly. People are talking about and then I got to interrupt that conversation and talk to someone else. Yeah, it's like, I'm like, and then I'm like reading emails on someone's computer. It's so, I was like, I don't like this at all. Like, this is not what I'm here for. And but again, impressive as fuck. The whole thing, very impressive. But is it actually serving that entertainment experience? Yeah, I don't really think so. And I got to say, I'm very tired of this open world approach where you just like, you just litter tiny objects all over the goddamn place. Like, I'm not a vacuum, you know. Not here to just, I want to just shoot stuff. I want to be a cool cyberpunk. And it makes sense in a world of scarcity, but I have money. I have gang connections. I have corporate connections in this world. I don't need to pick up every soda bottle. I just don't. Like, I just fucking don't, you know?
Right. It's not a survival game.
It's not a survival game. It's a shooter.
You're in a densely populated city with everything that you need. You don't need to like be picking up pencils off of every desk that you come across.
And they have these like lore sticks, is what I call it. Basically USB drives. So it's like all over the fucking place. They're also tiny. And so you find them just sort of like everywhere. Can't take like 3 steps without crushing one of these underfoot. But reading them, all it does is give you like more like another, you know, angle of the world. It'd be like an ad for something or someone's text to their mom or some shit. But so, none of them are usable. I can't read one and be like, oh, I'm in this location right now. This guy's talking about this door. And if I go,
there's not like the Fallout style little nuggets of information where they like mention a cache somewhere. Like if you like go into the sewer to the northwest.
There's none of that engagement with, I don't know. So an incredible technical feat. Is it a good game? My vote, no, literally no. But if you want to go have that experience, like, you know, go for it. And I'm not like shaming anybody who's having a good time. It's still fun to poke around in, but like, am I interested in returning? No, I'm gonna go play Dragon Age, to be honest, this weekend.
That's so where basically, I'm at. Looks good, technically impressive world. Gameplay is a mixed bag.
It's a mixed bag. But maybe it might be your mixed bag. I don't know. Just not mine. So there's my review score.
We've all got our own mixed bags.
Mm-hmm.
All right, maybe I'll wait for a sale.
Yeah.
All right, let's get on to some questions. All right, these questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. Highest upvoted question comes from Chalosis, who says, I love being the jack of all trades, master of none when it comes to making games. But everyone says it's a bad strategy. Who's wrong? Me or everyone? Is this a sustainable strategy?
I like how you're not – Chalosis is not included in everyone. It's me or everyone.
Well, I mean, everyone's wrong. Just you and everyone, you know? We're all wrong all the time. So just, you know, put that out of your mind. Mm-hmm. Don't even worry about that part because that's a given.
Yep.
I think when it comes to being – jack of all trades, it really just depends on whether you have the opportunity to be part of a team.
Yes.
Because if you are trying to make games by yourself and you're like, I am only a programmer. I don't care about art. I don't care about making things look good. Well, you're probably going to make a real shit piece. So if you are a solo dev, be a jack of all trades, you know,
and you're going to learn a lot.
Yeah, you're going to learn a lot and you're going to make some pretty cool stuff and you get to participate in the whole pipeline. You know, one day you'll be making a bunch of art assets and the next day you'll go to implement them and you'll be like, wait.
Why haven't I done this to me?
Wait a minute. This is bad. And honestly, you know, that's my background. I spent my first couple years making my own games and that actually made it far easier when Sam and I started working together at first. Made it far easier for me to know what to talk to him about when he started doing art. because I knew what I needed.
That leads us to the ideal, because the ideal is that you're a jack of all trades, master of one.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know? That you know some stuff about everything, but you know a lot about one thing. It's the T-shaped developer, right? Shallow knowledge in many areas and deep knowledge in one area.
Yeah.
Just keep doing everything. And then if at some point an opportunity comes up to jump onto a team, you'll be able to bring a lot to that team, and then you can specialize.
Oh, and the fact is there's no like ideal amount of knowledge in any particular domain, just as a concept, right? There's the matching up of what you are capable of and the problem that you're trying to solve. Or in the case of game development, the problem that you've created for yourself that you're not trying to solve, right?
That's all we do, you know?
That's all, yeah. We're just inventing problems. None of these things exist. We're just inventing it, right? So so if there's a mismatch between your various skills that you have and the thing that you're trying to make, then that's a problem. But if there isn't, then it's not a problem. So
no problem.
Well, I think it turns out the context matters, just, you know, like it always does.
Yeah, and importantly, you know, I think the interesting thing is if you're working by yourself and you are designing the things yourself, you know, design is functionally problem solving with constraint. That's literally all it is. And so the weird thing about it is, you know, we've talked about this with regard to the art, about using GameMaker, our web tech, the total team size we have. Like the way we solve our problems is based on the constraints we have. You know, we're not out here trying to get VC money to solve a problem that we can't even solve ourselves. And that's sort of like what the goal is. We're solving things for the games that we want to make in the ways that we can. And so the interesting thing about the only problematic, you know, thinking or framing around this stuff can be that you don't have enough X, Y, or Z to do what you want to do, because sometimes it's about changing your design or changing your targeting so that you make something. And maybe that might not be sufficient, because sometimes it isn't, you know, vision-wise, you do need to go get some skills, but oftentimes it is perfectly fine to go do. And also, the rest of that quote is really important, which is jack of all trades, master of none, still better than a master of one, I'm pretty sure. So,
everybody sort of forgets the second half of the saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is not good to literally only know one thing, even if you know that thing very well. But I would also argue that you can't be a master of one without also knowing a whole bunch of other stuff. Because
100%.
Everything has context. Everything makes more sense in context. And things do not exist in isolation. So you can't be like a master programmer but not be able to write an English sentence, assuming you're in an English-speaking place, not be able to write an English sentence, right? Like you can't really be, because part of what you do as a master programmer is articulate concepts to other human beings, right?
Write documentation.
For the
software you make.
Yeah. And so so you can't – it's just not a thing. It's not a thing just to be really good at a thing, right, and leaving all else. So yeah. So I guess everyone's wrong is still
Everyone's still wrong, just as we suspected. All right. Next question comes from Tim Conceivable, who says, I have the hardest time completing things that I have little interest in or find overwhelming to deal with. Probably something everyone struggles with from time to time, but it's even worse with ADHD.
True fact.
What are some methods you have found helpful to tackle the tasks you dread? Okay, I have one example that is like always in the back of my mind. Okay. When I was in law school, for starters, reading cases is real fucking boring. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so boring. So
what's the a case? Like, what's the context?
It's a judge's opinion that they've rendered about a case, right?
So you're basically chock full of legal jargon and
Well, and it's dictated. So if you read it's not actually structured for reading. It was structured so that the person writing it down as the judge was speaking could just get it onto paper as quickly as they could. And as you know, like when people speak, they don't speak in complete sentences or paragraphs. Mm-hmm. They have long pauses. They backtrack on things, you know, whatever. Judges actually are much better than just about anybody at dictating, because that's all they do, but it's still a lot. So what you got to do in law school is when you're studying an area of law, what you're really studying is a lot of times these cases. Mm. And that's how you learn about how the law gets applied. And then you take exams on it, right? So one of the core strategies that law students use is this idea of outlining. They go through these different cases, they go through their notes from class, and they put together this giant outline, oftentimes 50, 100 pages long, because all of the exams are open note, right? Which you think like, oh, it's an open note exam. That's great for me because I can just look up the answers.
It never
problem
is.
Problem is that means that it gives the professors an excuse to sort of build the exams around any of the most obscure, pointless things because they expect you to be able to look it up, right? So it's kind of like an arms race problem. And so many of my classmates focused their studying and outlining strategy around compiling literally as much information as they could so that they could look it up, right? This is, if you're a person with ADHD, if you're a person who has a hard time doing things that are boring, what this amounts to is you would be going through information that is obvious or that you already know over and over and over and over again and rewriting it and recompiling it, right? It's terrible. Mm-hmm. It's just terrible.
Bore me to tears.
Yeah. So my strategy was to start with my outline or start with my notes, but turn them into questions. Any question that I couldn't answer, I would migrate to the next document. So my study document just kept shrinking, right? So like anything that I just knew right offhand, never looked at it again. And then I would go through that document, figure out the answers to those questions. A few days later, look at it. Anything I couldn't answer, I'd bring to the next document. By the time test day came, I came in with a single sheet of paper.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, everybody else had like 100 fucking pages of notes. I just had a single sheet of paper. I did great. It worked great.
I assume you finished before everybody else too, because you,
I wasn't flipping around. I knew the stuff I knew, and I knew the stuff I didn't know, because all the stuff I did know was on that one sheet of paper, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it is about recognizing where the boring parts are, and seeing if you can just not, you know, if you can find a way to just cut those out of the process.
Well, sometimes if there's a problem you can't solve, one of the options you have is to solve a different problem, right? So the problem here is not how do I outline efficiently as a person with ADHD. It's how do I approach this studying task in an interesting enough way as a person with ADHD, such that it actually fits with my approach.
Yeah, so that the end result is you have studied for this test and you can.
Yeah, so sometimes it's about shifting where you believe the problem is, so that you can have basically it's like doing design, right? You basically do a little design session on it, which in itself usually is fun, and figure out how to solve it. So that's a good one. It's very good.
Right. Yeah.
Adam, about you? Do you have any? Right, good.
No, that's it.
So you have any?
Good, Adam.
Things.
Yeah, so I think I don't have a good general strategy, because mine is similar in the sense that I find studying incredibly boring. I find slowly learning things incredibly boring and very hard to do. And so my approach towards learning new things so that I could because the first part of learning new things is always shitty, right? Because like you don't know what's happening, you're confused, everything's new, so then you're. And then also usually it's dry. So it's like, it's boring. You don't know what's happening. So it's just, it sucks, right? Also true with starting a new project. You don't know how you're going to solve these problems. So, and also the problem is probably boring. So it's just like, it all starts over again, right? So for me, for learning purposes, I would always make it more than I could handle to be interesting. So like the best I ever did in college was when I took a workload that my advisor told me was too much. And that was my best year was that year, because I had so much shit to do that the hard part was finding out how to like get away with like just doing enough in each place to get it all done. Right.
Which turned out to be your optimal way of operating.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so I didn't spend time in being like in this one class being like, oh, let me like compile this, really, really thorough, really good way of doing a thing, because I didn't have time to, right? So then the problem I had to solve was like, how do I accomplish the same goal without it? So it was basically a trial by fire kind of thing.
So you created a structural environment where you had to operate kind of in your best way, in a higher pressure, more exciting
right.
kind of an atmosphere.
Which certainly wouldn't work for everybody, but it did work for me. And that's also how then I've learned them kind of since then on out. So when I sat down to learn the new, more modern web programming practices before I built Rumpus a few years ago, it was the same deal. I was like, okay, what do I need to know? I just did some Googling to find out kind of what I needed to learn about. Then I just bought like 3 books and I read them all. Right. And I just did it. And of course, on the one hand, those were boring to read. But on the other hand, I had a goal, right? Which was like, I got to read these 3 books. Like, and I'm going to barely understand fucking any of it as I'm going. So I'm not going to get distracted by the fact that I don't know what's happening. I just like power through it because then I come away with that, with this like good rough idea of how this thing works, that I can then go to the part that is a lot more interesting, which is try to build a thing. Right. Mm-hmm. And then otherwise, when I was in grad school, I had a similar approach to kind of what Seth did, where it was that idea of trying to make it so that the only things I had to focus on were the things that I didn't know, which is that's basically what flashcards are, right? So I used a flashcard because I had to memorize like which scientists authored which papers with which discoveries, and then for each one of those papers, it's all primary literature, so it's like for each one of these papers, what experiments did they did? What did the graphs look like? What were the weaknesses in each one? All that kind of stuff, right? And so like, so my dissertation had its citation list is like 220 papers or something like that, right? And so I had to know every fucking one of those papers, right? They're dry. You're not allowed to write fun stuff as a scientist. And so dry as fuck papers. And so it was the same approach. I would just build different lists of things and then just like flip through them and then test myself on it and then whittle it down to the stuff that I didn't know. And then otherwise I would do everything that I could to convert boring specific knowledge into general knowledge so that I could infer close enough the answers to specific questions using general knowledge. Right. So that's always been my approach, is to try to get the gist of a thing and focus on the gist so that the details are just like side effects of the gist of the thing, you know.
But what about,
I think you go.
I was going to say, I think the fun part about this though, is that actually by doing this sort of, focusing only on what you don't know, then it actually turns it almost into a measurable outcome. Because if you have I think the mistake a lot of people make with flashcards is they'll be like, I got my 100 flashcards. I'm just going to keep running through this stack. Mm-hmm. Just keep running through I'm just going to go through all 100 flashcards like once a day.
And it feels good to know the ones that you know, right? So like you hit, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but the problem is like you just keep going over stuff that you just don't need to go over because you know it, right? If instead the goal is like, I'm gonna go through this pile of flashcards until there aren't any left, right? And it basically like anytime you get one right, just set it aside. And you're making a new stack, like a continually shrinking stack of cards that you're struggling with until eventually you just got like 2 cards. Focus on those for a little while until you really get it, you know?
But again, for me, it still always has been the how and the why, which is also why I loved science, right? Is because you get to, if you learn the big picture, then you can just compute, right? You can compute the little stuff because like, but this sort of same kind of concept could also work in law potentially, just as another example, right? Because these cases are written by human beings, right? Who have certain ways of thinking. And so if you, after you've read like a case or two from a particular judge, you sort of think about like the kinds of opinions this judge has, right? And why, and how that person's getting there, right? Like what is their mental framework? What is their view of society? What is their view of the Constitution or whatever? Like what is the thing that's like leading them to these conclusions?
Yep.
Because if you can figure that out really well, then even all the little details you forget, you could guess the right answer more often.
Yeah,
you're
like, I'm pretty sure they would say something like this about this. Yeah,
exactly. Right.
So I'm just going to go with that.
Here's my question with this, though, because I think both of what you guys are talking about are when you're in pursuit of a bigger thing that itself you could probably get excited about, whether it's like, I'm going to complete law school or I'm going to be a scientist, whatever the fuck. But I think there's a very important question here, which is what about the regular stuff? Like you got to take out the trash and do X, Y, Z chores, whatever else.
Yeah, that stuff I just don't do if I can get away with it. Or if I have to do it, I'd put on a podcast that I'm entertaining myself via other means that don't interfere with my ability to do that boring stuff.
Yeah, I would say too, like there's something about having an issue like ADHD, where those larger goals generally don't really matter that much because the thing that you're currently doing has to be engaging.
Yep.
Right. And so even though those things occurred in the context of trying to become a scientist or trying to get through law school or whatever the case may be, my finance background is a good example of that, which is that I don't care about finance. It's not that big of a deal to be able to predict the price of a stock because you're wrong, right? Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter. But what was fun about it was that when I did finance, I did the exact thing that Adam was talking about, which is I declared a finance major with one semester to go, and then I had to take all the finance classes in one semester in order to get through it. And it was my best semester. Not because I was in pursuit of some huge thing that I was really passionate about, but just because it was really engaging, to just on a day to day, to have that many things bouncing around in my head and to deal with, So in a lot of times we've talked on the podcast about trying to figure out how to swim with the current of life instead of against it, which means think about the structure around you, mm-hmm. think about the environment that you're in and how that is reinforcing your tendencies to succeed or suppressing your tendencies to succeed, right? So that's simple stuff. Like if you find yourself upset because every morning you pick up and the first thing you do every morning, you get up and the first thing you do is you pick up your phone and browse a bunch of terrible news and feel sad, right? What if you charged your phone in a complete, the farthest corner of your living space, mm-hmm. from where you sleep so that it's going to be a while before you get to your phone and you can start to break the habit, yeah. those kinds of things.
And what I used to do for particularly, because none of this is to say that I still wasn't bored a lot of the time, which was true. And what I would often do, and this was, in the before times, would be go to a coffee shop with nothing but the materials required for me to do the thing, right?
No phone, no laptop, because we didn't really have.
Yeah, and then I still get interested, right? Because now it's a change of scene. I'm still getting engaged because I get a cup of coffee and it's I'm having that whole experience. And then I'm having more of a – I've converted that boring task into an experience of some sort.
That's right? I'm just realizing that's exactly what I used to do, because I would go – the best time I had was actually when I started going to the library to study, which I think I only went there literally, I think the last three quarters of my senior year was the first time I was in the library.
And you're like, oh, this is kind of nice.
Yes.
I get it now.
Because what I'd do is I'd stop by, get a coffee at the little coffee shop thing. And then I'd go in there and it's the mood in the place. It's the scene. I think that the thing that causes more struggle though is when you are in a context of your own making, at home, you got to work through some mail or you got to do X, Y, or Z. I think that the difficulty and kind of maybe what we're circling around is that it's sometimes it can be far more engaging and better to step back and ask yourself how to solve that problem for yourself than to just try to do it, if that makes sense. Solving the problem of maybe you want to always get through a huge stack of mail. The reality might be that if when you sit down to – because everyone's very particular about certain things. So for me in particular, I do actually like to have my desk relatively tidy. So if there's mail that I want to force myself to deal with, I just put it on my desk.
Yep.
That's the step I have to take, and then it will literally be handled within 2 days because it just annoys the shit out of me, right? And I won't – I'm not going to move it out of the room. I'm not going to take it back downstairs or something. So there's ways to kind of, think about those points where you are very particular about how things work, whatever else, and you can use those as these little kind of jam points.
Just seeing which is the hardest part, right? So for me, for stuff that I don't want to do, it's the inertia. It's getting started. That's always the hard part. And so what I try to do is have rituals around it. So for me, I do the same thing I used to do where I would even when I was in grad school, there was a cafeteria on the first floor. And so I would just – probably three or four times a day, I would just write down the thing, go get a cheap cup of coffee, right? Or then sort of down the hall, the pharmacology department just had just fucking garbage coffee just available at all times. And so I would go drink that like also three or four times. I was had a lot of coffee back then. but it was part of a ritual. It's like, because and it's one of those things, like in retrospect, I know what was happening was I was getting bored is what was happening, right?
Yep.
And so I would just go like begin the ritual again. This is what I do now at home. Now at home, usually three or four times during the workday, all of a sudden I'm like, I need a break. And I get up and I go downstairs and I make some tea or coffee, right? And it's like, it's part of that ritual of being like, because those things I associate with like getting work done is like having a warm cup of something, you know? Mm-hmm. And so as soon as I start getting bored,
cup.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it has to be a fresh cup. And it's part of the ritual though, right? Is I start to feel myself go in that spot, and now my automatic behavior is just to like go perform the ritual to kick things off. And otherwise for things like chores and stuff, because my inertia for those is also very hard to get over. I do it all in one fucking go. It's just like every Saturday morning. It's part of the routine. It's not even a routine, isn't like, it just happens. It's that I know this is the rule, right? On Saturday morning, I get up, I do like get mostly ready for the day like usual, but I don't shower yet because once I've showered, like this is my day now, you know, this is like,
yeah.
And so before that, just, like, vacuum the whole fucking house, do all the chores, do everything. And so that it's
get sweaty, get filthy.
Yep. And then I go right. Shower and now I'm like, okay, now it's back to like the life that I want to live, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good. I mean, yeah,
my shit, you know?
I just on Sunday I go to church.
Nice,
you know, church,
which is the church of chores. I try to put off everything that I possibly can until Sunday morning, yep. And then I just do all of it. Nice thing is in winter there's a lot less to do. You know, so all the leaves are already picked up. The yard's not doing anything. It's basically laundry day at that point. You know,
yeah, and for yard stuff for me, I just take advantage of the fact that that things like weeds and stuff just annoy me, and so all I have to do, I know, like in the summer, is I have to get outside. If I can get outside, weeds.
Once you're out there, that's just you'll see a weed and you just start pulling it.
Yeah, you can't just pull one weed because there's one right next to it. You know, so then like
the ADHD kicks in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you start playing a completionist game. You know,
yeah.
Indoor chores always suck, though. I don't know. I haven't ever found a time where I enjoyed doing indoor chores.
I think you can't change context. That's why. Like, there's no coffee shop outdoor equivalent because you're in your damn house.
Yeah.
You know, it's well, so hard.
I've found it's been very hard to maintain an exercise routine while working from home without being able to go to the gym, you know?
Yep.
Because, like, so we set up a home gym area, and my wife has been great about it. She's doing CrossFit from home. Like, we got a squat rack, we got barbell. Like, there's no excuse for me not to be just ripped as fuck right now, mm-hmm. because we have so many different ways for me to exercise at home.
but you have to go in there. Yeah. You got to decide to do it. You got to put on your gym clothes and you got to go in there.
Yeah. I mean, think about this. I'm working out in a room. Where from that room, I can see my own kitchen full of snacks, mm-hmm. full of beverages, ice cold beverages for me to drink. There's a table there. I can sit down and just have a snack and eat. You know, I'm looking at it. All I got to do is take three steps and walk through a doorway and boom, gym session over. It's snack time. I am just chill, mm-hmm. right? It is so much different than if you like. Same your library ritual, you know.
Yep.
If I say, hey, it's end of the workday, it's gym time, pack my bag, hop in the car, drive over to the gym, I'm there now. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm committed. You know, I'm going to do my whole workout. I'm going to finish the thing.
It's kind of like pulling the weeds, right? You go yeah. do one lift and you're like, well, man, I'm over here.
I mean, while I'm here, I guess I'll also do like back and some squats and stuff. So you do all that. And then, because there's a whole ritual, there's a process. And I can't just take three steps and suddenly be done with my workout, you know?
Yeah. So. For the at home workout stuff, I found I use an app called Seven, which is just a 7-ish minute workout thing. But importantly, what it is it's basically 30 seconds of a particular exercise and then 15 seconds off, no weights or anything like that. So it's the same thing where I don't have any excuses because literally as soon as I hit the button on my phone, it starts, right? Like I'm ready to go. And the fun thing about it though is that I haven't had a session where I stopped early on any of them, right? Because one, I know it's only like 7 minutes long, and two, it changes every 30 seconds. So I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm here for it because there's always something coming up that I'm, you know, excited to do or whatever, or try out. So again, it's like finding stuff that fits your mode
I think the mistake that people make is trying to force themselves to like to do the boring task.
Right? Yeah.
How do I change the task or my approach to the task so it's doable? But along with all this, like, if you do have something like ADHD that makes all of this stuff just like extra hard, then sometimes it's basically impossible to get that thing done, right? And so in some cases, you need medication to be able to actually get across these thresholds, right? There's not a solution where it's like, oh yeah, if you find this hard to do, then like here's the trick, right? Because as you heard, all three of us have different tricks. There's some relationships, like a lot of it's about forming rituals and stuff, right? But we all have different tricks, and some of them are more successful than others. And the reality, you know, I will absolutely admit for my own life is that outside of work, my life is basically chaos, and it works because I don't have kids, and I've got cats, which is, you know, both part of the chaos, but also, you know, it's a thing that I have to wrangle. But things work out for me because I've been able to design my home life, around the fact that I hate doing and will try not to do chores. Right. which is not an option for everybody. Right. But I think it's one of those important things to say, like, it as a company, and as a studio, and like on the podcast, talking about all the stuff that we do and all these process improvements that we make and all this kind of stuff, like that basically applies to work for me, you know, and at home, I'm just like, what can I not do? Cause it turns out you can get away with not doing most things, you know, if you know, for good or for ill.
Do you make yourself a "I'm not doing this today" checklist so you can check off all the things that you didn't do for the day?
I do that by having a checklist of things I'm supposed to do and then just not doing those things, which comes out, you know, comes out the same.
Yeah, you just rewrite the title afterward.
Yeah, things I didn't do.
To-do list, then you just pull an insert, like, to not do today.
Yeah, so I think
the fact is – Didn't do that.
Yeah, the fact is that this stuff is really hard, and it's easy. And I know I certainly did back 10 years ago, and I was really into getting things done and all these different – like trying to find all these different philosophies for how to accomplish it, you know. Everything's presented as like, oh, yeah, here's the way, right? Here's the trick. You do this, like, and then as long as you do it, if you don't do it this way, like if you're unable to still do the work, it's because you're not doing the system well enough, right? It's like, it's just back to your fault again. It's back to, or it's back to you. This wasn't the right system. You just got to go find this other system. This other person is espousing and so on. And the fact is, it's just hard. It just is.
It's a continuous
struggle.
Yeah. The idea that like, as you become an adult, that the same shit that annoyed you as a kid still is like troublesome sometimes, which is like doing little things. Seems like it shouldn't be an issue, but I think the reality is that you're a person. You're just a person.
Yeah, that's the real problem.
That's the problem. Yep. just trying to get by.
Yep. So hopefully some of those strategies help. Well, let us know. Let's know how it goes. That's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Coster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to the Discord, a way for you to donate, and links to the podcast archives. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.